You're listening to an RNIB Connect Radio podcast.
You join me here on London's Millbank at Tate Britain with Eliza Spindle, who's the assistant curator of the Edward Burr and Eiffel Kuchen exhibitions here at Tate Britain. Hello, Eliza, and welcome to RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
I suppose the first question would be is why did Tate think now was a good time to sort of shine a light on both these very influential artists with Edward Burr and Eiffel Kuchen?
Well, Edward Burr and Eiffel Kuchen are both fantastic artists who I guess have been a bit underappreciated over the years. They were working at a really similar time, starting in the 20s and 30s, through most of the 20th century, really. And Tate has amazing collections of both artists. In fact, we hold the archives of both Eiffel Kuchen and Edward Burr. So it really made sense to bring out the work of these artists and show them in parallel.
And I suppose if we concentrate a little bit on Edward Burr first, I mean, he sort of studied in London during the sort of 1920s. He went and visited Italy and Paris. He worked on costumes and set designs for Sadler's Wells Ballet and Ballet Rombo as well, and working on watercolours. But I suppose the sort of first question was he very much influenced by the sort of, I suppose, what they call the Roaring Twenties, the sort of interwar period and what was going on in the world at the time?
Absolutely. One of the first things he did was to go and visit Paris and the south of France in the Roaring Twenties as a young artist and immerse himself in the culture, in the clubs and street life and cabarets. And that was really where Edward Burr felt most at home, and that made its way into his artworks that depicted these really vibrant scenes of the Roaring Twenties in France.
And I suppose a lot of his sort of, I suppose his work very much is, some of its watercolours very bold and very graphic, but also depicting what's sort of happening in the world and, you know, when you're thinking of, you know, coming up to the Second World War and events like that.
Yeah, he lived in an extraordinary time period, starting out with, as I say, the Roaring Twenties, and then encountering the Harlem Renaissance in New York. But then he was in Spain at the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War in 1936, which was closely followed by the Second World War, which he experienced from home in Sussex. So Burr really found himself documenting and responding to all of these really life-changing events that were unfolding around him.
And how would you sort of describe those images, his work that he was producing at that time?
Well, we really start in the 20s and 30s with these really vibrant, pulsating, rhythmic depictions of dance halls and performances and cabarets that he was visiting in France and in New York. And then slowly, as the kind of violence and horrors of the Spanish Civil War start to unfold, you get this sort of darkness unfolding in his work, and it loses some of the joy and life and becomes a little bit more macabre and a bit more foreboding, reflecting his kind of horror at the violence that he was witnessing. And then finally, kind of later on, particularly as his declining health means that he's less able to travel, we see his paintings actually lose some of their human presence, and he starts to focus more on empty landscapes and the impact of humanity on the landscape, the kind of industry and the building of motorways in the post-war years. So you really see a kind of change in his approach throughout his career, really.
And I suppose his health, in a way, predicted his style, because his watercolours were very much painted on tabletop, flat, rather than working on an easel like oil painters would do. And I suppose that really influenced his style as well.
It really did. In fact, it influenced his decision to become an artist. The fact that he had fragile health from a young age meant that his parents let him go to art school and not follow such a conventional education. And then, as you say, watercolour became his preferred medium, because it meant that he could work flat on a table, he could rest his hands while he was doing it, which were often in a lot of pain. And it was altogether a more delicate medium that meant his hands weren't under such stress.
And he was, I think, one of the sort of great unknown artists of his time. Was that something because he didn't feel he was sort of, I suppose, part of that art world, that he wasn't bothered in it? Or did he not feel that his work was so good to be sort of, I suppose, included in the art world at the time?
I think partly it's because he shunned categorization. He didn't like to be placed in a box, to be told that he was a surrealist or a realist or anything like that. And he wasn't super interested in the art world and the kind of society around that. All he wanted to do was to make work. It was a kind of impulse for him that he just had to make work. He saw it almost as a drug to manage the pain of his arthritis. So for him, all he wanted to do was make. He wasn't so interested in the way his work was received or exhibited, and perhaps that's one of the reasons it's not been so well known over the years.
And what do you think people can take away from not only seeing his work, but all the great sort of Tate archive of his material here in Tate Britain?
I think it reveals Edward Burrough to be just such a rich and kind of well-rounded artist, I suppose. Going into the archive and digging out all of his record collections, his scrapbooks, all of the literature and books that he was reading, everything that he was absorbing that made its way into his paintings, you get this sense of this incredibly rich tapestry of sources that he was drawing on that come to life in his incredibly unique works.
And I suppose we should move on to Eiffel Cohen's work. And she was very influential and very much part of the surrealist movement at the time, and also had an interest in sort of myth and magic as well. And that came across in her work.
Absolutely. She started out working in a more kind of conventionally figurative way, doing compositions based on mythology or biblical subjects. And she slowly became interested in surrealism and became affiliated with that group. But a bit like Edward Burrough, she really charted her own course and resisted being tied to one specific group. So she was using lots of surrealist techniques, but exploring her own ideas that were kind of centered around mysticism and the occult and various kind of spiritual traditions that she was drawing on.
And like Burrough, she also traveled as well. She traveled to Italy, to Greece and other countries. Did that sort of affect her work and sort of change her work in any way?
She was less well-travelled than Burrough, and I think because her work is less figurative, it's less about documenting what she saw and the kind of people that she encountered on her travels, but definitely her encounters with different landscapes that she saw in Greece and also in Cornwall, where she eventually settled, had an amazing impact on her work and her style.
And was it right that her sort of, I suppose, interest in occult sort of got her expelled from the surrealist movement? Is that correct?
That's what the story goes, yeah. I think, you know, she didn't want to give up her interests and affiliations with other groups and societies that she was involved with around the occult. And so she kind of severed ties formally with the surrealist group, but she very much remained in close contact with several of its members and remained interested in surrealism.
And did that affect her work in any way, being sort of, you know, sort of excluded from that surrealist movement that she was very much part of?
It very much meant that she was highly individual, ploughing her own furrow all the time, and made a lot of work, which we have on display in the exhibition, that was really for her own personal investigation and her own explorations, that wasn't exhibited publicly, but that she used to explore her ideas around the occult and mysticism and what she termed sex magic, this unity of masculine and feminine and a kind of divine eroticism that she explored in a lot of her work from the 40s onwards.
And she obviously did move down to Cornwall, but also spent time in London as well. Did she sort of want to sort of keep those connections with the art world in London, but also being down in Cornwall with the peace and sort of quietness and I suppose all that sort of myth that's in Cornwall as well?
Yeah, so throughout the 40s, she did move back and forth between London and Cornwall, and I think maintaining her connection to the art world in London was important for a while, and she had major exhibitions at the Mayer Gallery, which was a real centre for the Surrealist group in particular. But increasingly, you know, she spent more and more time and permanently settled in Cornwall, and that was really her home, and she relished its kind of peacefulness and quiet and the fact that it was remote from the rest of the world, and increasingly rallied against the incursion of traffic noise and tourists to Cornwall. So it was very much a kind of retreat for her, yeah.
And what do you think would be her legacy today, you know, sort of on other artists as we look back on her work?
I think her exploration of this idea of a kind of divine feminine and its link to the earth is something that has inspired a lot of artists subsequently, including a range of contemporary artists. And I think really just visitors to the exhibition can encounter somebody who was just so committed and so devoted to exploring all of these ideas in such a unique and serious way. And I think that's really inspiring to artists and visitors as well.
And it's great to have both Edward Burrough and Eiffel Cohen's exhibitions here in Tate Britain. What do you think people coming to both exhibitions will sort of take away from their visit?
I think on the face of it, Edward Burrough and Aethel Gahoon are two very different artists, and they were. They were both sort of on the fringes of surrealism, but engaged with it really differently, and their work looks very different. But the more we've been working on the two exhibitions in parallel, the more similarities have come through, particularly when we see Edward Burrough start to look at the landscape in his later years and his interest in kind of mythological figures and ghosts that inhabit his landscape scenes has real connections with some of Aethel Gahoon's interests in a kind of magical landscape. And also, you know, they both were very experimental with their medium, the kind of materials that we're using. So Burrough was working mostly with watercolour. Aethel Gahoon used a lot of watercolour as well, but also, you know, interesting experiments with dripping enamel paint or this technique called decalcomania, where she pressed two sheets of paper together, a bit like a Rorschach inkblot test, to create these amazing images. So, yeah, amazing kind of experimentation in unusual ways from both artists.
Well, the Edward Burrough and Aethel Gahoon's exhibitions continue here at Tate Britain until the 19th of October 2025. Audio-described guided tours of both exhibitions can be booked in advance by either emailing hello@tate.org.uk or by calling 020 787 8888. Eliza, thank you very much indeed for joining me here on R&IB Connect Radio and giving me a great insight into both the Edward Burrough and Aethel Gahoon exhibitions here at Tate Britain.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
For more interviews, features and shows, go to your favourite podcast provider and search for R&IB Connect Radio.